morning. May it please the court. I'm Fred Heblich. I'm an assistant federal public defender from Charlottesville, and I represent the appellant Daniel Brown. We raised two issues in this case. One is a suppression issue. The other has to do with a double jeopardy issue. And I'm going to address the suppression issue because it's probably most important. The trial judge gave two reasons for denying the suppression motion. He said that it was late, and then he said that it had no merit to it. Now, we are not going to argue that it was justifiably late. Our argument is that it wasn't late at all because it was filed before the trial as required by Rule 12. And
but he denied it on the merits.
He did both.
Right. So what difference does it make whether he about the lateness? And doesn't going to the merits kind of eliminate that as an issue?
Yes. Yes. Yes, sir. Now, what he did is he said, I'm going to decide this on the merits, and I'm going to decide it based on what you filed. Those were the judge's words. So in other words, the only thing he has in front of him is the motion to suppress. The trial lawyer asks for an evidentiary hearing, and that's denied. And the judge just says, it's late. I'm not going to make the jury wait around. So he denies the evidentiary hearing. He says,
you filed the motion on Saturday, and the trial was starting Monday morning.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. So he said the motion wasn't enough.
That's right.
So would you say it'd be fair to the judge that he took what you said in the motion as true and said that doesn't cut it?
He would have to.
He would have to. So he took what you said as true.
What
you said is true doesn't make a case, the judge is right.
That's right. But he was wrong.
Part of the problem is you're saying the judge shortchanged you in terms of a hearing and everything, but that was something you brought on yourself with this Saturday night motion.
Well, I didn't try the case, and I'm not going to blame anybody.
Wrong thing to say. You don't say that you didn't try the case.
You're the only one we have here. You're responsible for the whole thing.
I'm not going to shirk
my
responsibility.
You're a guarantor. What happened?
I'm not going to shirk my responsibility. He did. He filed it at midnight on Saturday before a Monday trial. But he's entitled to rely on Rule 12. The rule says before the trial.
Well, but the timeliness is out. The judge ruled on the merits. And the question is, what I'm getting at, if the face of the motion shows it's without merit, the judge is correct.
That's right. But the motion does.
You say the motion's enough. But they had a search warrant, and they went down to the medical facility to try to find the computers, right?
That's right.
And because there was criminal activity, they said, shown on the computers.
That's right.
And they went through the facility, and they didn't find anything.
Well, they found a computer, but
they didn't find what they were looking for.
That's right.
And then these fellas drove up in an ambulance?
Ambulance.
Drove up in an ambulance. And the motion says the officers introduced themselves, stated that they represented internet crimes against children. This is outside the facility, right?
That's outside.
Outside the facility in a public area. And they ask them, do you guys, quote, Brown and Yarborough, we're talking about Brown here, have any laptops in the vehicle? And Brown answered yes.
That's right.
Doesn't that, on the face of it, take care of this case?
No.
Well, Mr. Brown says, I got a laptop in the vehicle, and they seized it.
They did seize it.
And they didn't need a warrant to seize it.
Why didn't they need a warrant?
It was not in the facility where they had the warrant for. The warrant's irrelevant. And he told them he had it, and they knew it was criminal activity on it.
Well, they didn't know there was criminal activity.
The warrant says they do know. They knew it.
The warrant doesn't say that.
Well, it does.
The warrant. You don't have the warrant in evidence. You don't have the warrant in the record.
We know what your motion says.
The motion says that the place to be searched, as described in the warrant, the place to be searched is the inside of the building of medical transport. It doesn't say anything about premises or parking lot or vehicles.
But the warrant requirement, it doesn't there's a requirement under the Fourth Amendment or doctrine of the Fourth Amendment that overrides a particular warrant requirement. It's an overall requirement of reasonableness. And given the fact that they got a search warrant and given the fact that the search warrant was for computers and was this particular building and the only people that had the computers were Brown and Yarborough and the rest, to require officers to walk away from it or not to seize the computer, just it doesn't make common sense. You want officers to get warrants, and if you want them to get warrants, you don't want them to be in a straitjacket. And this is plainly incident to the authority and reasonably incident to the authority conferred by the warrant. It's right outside the door. The ambulance drives up. It wasn't an ambulance from another company. It was a medical transport ambulance, and it had the very thing they were looking for. And so are we supposed to say, well, we're going to throw the whole thing out because there's this little difference between a car and an identically labeled building parked right next to the car with the things to be seized listed in the warrant right there in the car?
Well, that you're talking about, this is Patterson and Garrison. These are the cases that this court has decided that talk about the objective reasonableness of the officer in interpreting the warrant. But the court would have to, A, have the warrant in front of it, and B, hear evidence to determine whether the officers acted reasonably. The warrant was for specifically computers found inside the building. This was just completely serendipitous that Brown and Yarborough drove up in the ambulance, and Brown had a lot of
problems. Is there any suggestion of some type of implied curtilage in a warrant like that?
I'm sorry, implied?
Curtilage.
Not in a commercial building. And the reason the facts weren't developed in this, and they're important, because the reason that the search warrant was so narrowly drawn, and there's a little bit of this in the record because Rudman, the detective who applied for the warrant, talks about these things.
If the officers had a warrant for the search of a computer in a building and they go in, and from circumstances it appears as if somebody threw that laptop computer laying on the ground outside the building, maybe threw it out of the window when the officers came in with the warrant, could they seize that computer?
They might have authority
and
to do that.
What?
If
based
there was
what?
Something to
but
suggest.
Wait. But it's not in the building.
But you're adding the fact that there's a suggestion that it was removed from the building outside.
I'm just adding that I'm asking you to entertain the possibility that under some circumstances there could be an allowance of seizure or something outside the building described in the warrant.
Well, and that's, I think, Patterson and Garrison. Those are the cases, the objective. But I mean, those cases talk about interpreting the warrant and applying the warrant. And that's what Judge Wilkinson's talking about.
I think the warrant here just served to get them there and gave them authority to go into the building. But what they were looking for wasn't in the building. It was out there, and it was in the ambulance when it drove up.
But they didn't.
And if they hadn't seized it after your client said, yes, do you have laptops? Yes, in the vehicle. If they hadn't taken it, they should have been fired.
They didn't know. They had no articulable suspicion that it was evidence of crime.
Well, they had probable cause.
They had probable cause issued by the magistrate.
The magistrate issued the warrant for computers inside the building.
For medical transport.
Medical transport. And what I was going to explain was that the reason the warrant is drawn so narrowly is because the building was shared by two businesses. Medical transport was in half of the building.
This ambulance was not an ambulance of the other business.
I'm sorry?
The ambulance was not, the vehicle was not a vehicle of the co-tenants.
Well, no, but the parking lot was shared.
But the vehicle was not, there weren't any other cars, wasn't an unmarked vehicle or just a regular passenger vehicle or the vehicle of another commercial establishment. It was a medical transport vehicle right outside of the medical transport building. I don't know why the probable cause issued in the warrant, why this wouldn't be incident to the warrant and why this wouldn't be an exigent circumstance, because if they did not take it after this meeting with the defendant occurred, the stuff would have, the computer or the data would likely have, very likely have disappeared, or an attempt to dispose of it would have been made. So there is a doctrine of exigent circumstances if it's, as long as it's reasonable and the warrant provides a certain probable cause foundation for it.
Well, the warrant provided a probable cause foundation for searching inside of the building because...
But you're not answering the question. The question is exigent circumstances as to Brown's laptop computer when the officers knew there was something on it. And the search warrant isn't, I mean, this is sort of a different theory, which I think is quite frankly appealing under these facts. You don't have to rely on the warrant itself as a warrant, but as a warrant which gives totality of the circumstances that leads to the question of the exigent circumstances, which would not then require a warrant to seize that computer outside the building. What about that?
Well, it's a warrantless search. I understand what I'm understanding is a warrantless search, but the fact that they already had a warrant is something that they can consider.
It's a warrantless search. It's a warrantless seizure, but they had additional information. They had information not only from the warrant. They knew that they had tried to execute the warrant and, according to your motion, conducted a search but did not find computers relevant to their investigation. So they knew the computers they were looking for weren't there. And then Brown and Yarborough returned. They weren't there when they did the search. They returned to the medical transport location, quote, driving an ambulance.
That's correct.
Now, medical transport sort of sounds like it's an operation that outfit that operates ambulances.
It is.
And these guys show up in an ambulance, and they say, we're here. We represent internet crimes against children. And they ask, do you guys, Brown and Yarborough, have any laptops in the vehicle? Brown answered, yes. Based on that information, what's a reasonable officer to do, relying on that, all that objectively? What's he to do? Well, he seized the laptop.
That's correct.
And it seems to me that's absolutely logical.
Well, if you look at it from the hindsight of that they seized the laptop and eventually they find the evidence on it, then it makes all the sense in the world. But the Fourth Amendment protects is unreasonable searches and seizures.
But the point is that what Judge King just laid out doesn't sound too unreasonable to me. Does it sound unreasonable to you?
Well, if you have...
Not looking backward at it, but looking at the facts they had at the time. They knew, I don't want to need to restate it, they had the search warrant which allowed them to search that building for a computer, and then it wasn't there, but the people who worked in that building showed up. One of them indicated he had something on that computer akin to what they were looking for. Isn't that correct?
No, it's not correct.
Did he not indicate to them he had...
After they seized it, the one officer takes the computer from his arms and takes it into the building. And then they take Brown into the building and they interrogate him. And they're in two different rooms. And in the course of the interrogation, the police lie to Brown and they tell Brown... There's a story about... The computer has a fingerprint, and we can tell what computer...
That doesn't have anything to do with what the officers did back there. They had already seized the computer.
They're creating exigent circumstances.
Yeah, but on the basis of the facts laid out in the motion, which you said we have to take as true, and which Judge Moon had to take as true, because that's what he ruled on.
That's right.
And he just summarily, he said, I've read this, and it's without merit.
Right. He said, I don't think there was a search. That's what the judge said. I don't think he even reached the seizure issue.
There was a seizure.
Pardon?
There was a seizure.
And the exigent circumstances argument turns on what did the police know at the time they, what were the exigent circumstances at the time the police took possession, they seized the computer. They didn't even know, they didn't know whether Brown had bought that computer the day before. They didn't know how long he'd had it. They didn't know whether there was a router. They'd already seized the computers inside of the building, and they were in the course of looking at them when Brown and Yarbrough showed up. And they wanted to interview Brown and Yarbrough because they had evidence that Brown and Yarbrough were on duty at the time that there was child pornography that was being downloaded inside the business.
All right, thank you, Mr. Hedlund.
Thank you, Judge.
You've reserved rebuttal time. Ms. Healy, whenever you're ready.
Morning, Your Honor. Nancy Healy for the United States. May it please the court. I think Your Honors have hit upon one of the most important foundations in this particular case, and it's that the Fourth Amendment requires reasonableness, and that's really the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment. And we also know that the law that has been out there encourages police officers to get warrants, which is what happened in this particular case. The government's view of this case is that there was no search of the computer, of course, until a second warrant, which was referred to during the hearing and during...
But there was a seizure of it.
There was a seizure of it. But I think in some ways that could be looked at as simply a consensual encounter. At the time that Mr. Brown and Mr. Yarbrough pulled up in the ambulance, they came
wait,
up...
Wait. Are you saying that the facts of this case is that he consented to them taking his computer?
I think the search
warrant... There would be a yes or no, and then you can answer it. Or is the government asserting that he consented to the seizure of his computer at the time it was seized?
I think it was both within reason...
You asserting that under the facts of this case, he consented to have his computer seized?
I think it could be looked at as a consent, but it was also within the scope... The
government's never argued consent before.
You don't have a district court finding on consent.
Well, we had a very small, obviously, district court finding. We did state in the hearing that it was given over upon request.
Do you think that your other argument is so weak you have to raise consent now?
No, I
don't.
Then
why would you stand up in front of us and the first thing you say is consent?
I'm sorry, Your Honors.
I'm just asking you. Why would you do that?
Because if you look at some of the case law that revolves around...
Wait a second. Have you argued consent before in this case until right now?
We said that they asked for the computer and he gave it over to them.
But that doesn't mean consent. But you said there was a consensual search. You made that argument in your brief.
Not a search. We didn't see it as a search.
A seizure.
It is a seizure. It's absolutely a seizure.
And the thrust of your argument is it was a consensual seizure.
No, that it was a reasonable. I wanted to add that as an alternative.
All right, let me have you back up then.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So you feel compelled to say that now for what reason?
As an alternative or additional basis on which to find that the recovery of that computer was reasonable.
Because you don't think your primary argument is strong enough?
No, that's not it at all. I did want to raise that as an issue because I didn't hear it before. But I do think...
Why didn't you raise it with Judge Moon then?
I had very little time to respond, obviously, to...
Sure you did, but you had Sunday and Monday morning.
We did, but I think even Chavez... And actually, I would like at some point to raise the issue of the timeliness issue, which I know...
But the judge didn't rely on timeliness.
The judge actually relied on both. If you take a look at page... I think it was
He think it's out of time, but he ruled on the merits. That timeliness issue got to do with it?
Well, I do think it's important for future cases to look at the timeliness issue because I don't agree that... Mr. Heblich has correctly stated that motions may be filed up to the day of trial. I would like to address that at some point.
You think a fair reading of the record is that the judge actually also determined it on timeliness?
I do.
And for that reason, you think that's still in play. Whether or not we decide to accept it, you have to live with what we accept.
That's correct.
But your argument is that the rule is still in play, and you think, I take it you're going to argue, that's a proper basis to have rejected this motion as well.
I believe Mr. Brown argued that there was an abuse of discretion, obviously, in denying the motion on timeliness basis. And the government's position is that
why was it untimely under the rule?
Why was it untimely under
the rule? Yeah, why was it untimely?
Okay.
That's your argument, isn't it?
It's part of my argument, although I'd like to get to the merits first because I do think the merits
are important. Will you answer my question
Yes,
first?
I will. I'm happy to answer it. So,
can you do it quickly or not?
Yes, I can. So the rule actually was amended in 2002. Most of the cases that were relied upon in the brief, such as Chavez, which talks about the abuse of discretion standard.
Now, what rule are you talking about?
Rule 12B and Rule 47. So prior to the 2000...
Not talking about any local rules?
No.
All right.
Prior to 2002, Rule 12B didn't even reference Rule 47. In 2002, when there was an amendment, all of a sudden specifically incorporated into Rule 12B1, it stated Rule 47 applies to pretrial motions.
And a motion to suppress is a pretrial motion, and Rule 47 has a seven-day requirement.
Correct, and that changed in 2002, too, because before 2002, there was no requirement, any deadline.
Right.
So the government's position is that is a default.
I thought that, I followed the steps in the argument, which was that the amendment was made, Rule 47 applies to the pretrial motion. Motion to suppress is a pretrial motion. Party must serve it at least 7 days before the hearing date. But even if there were no rules at all, wouldn't a district court have a certain inherent authority as a just as the trial manager and someone who's responsible for the orderly progression of litigation through that court when a trial is scheduled to begin, what was it, Monday morning?
Correct.
And somebody files a motion on Saturday evening. I don't know whether it was Saturday or Sunday because it seemed to be at midnight.
11:15.
It's first of all inconsiderate to other litigants and to the trial court. It throws the schedule off because you're going to get a request for a continuance. It's obviously not the way to run a train. And I suppose in rules of this sort, there's always a good cause exception of some sort or an excusable neglect exception of some sort. But here, this particular seizure had taken place many months before, had it not? So there was no dearth of information or no last-minute discovery that would have justified a hearing this late in the day.
And I think late filings of motion prejudice the government in terms of formulating a cogent and a reasonable response within a short period of time during last-minute trial preparation, plus it inconveniences a jury veneer.
You just think that when you read those rules together, there's a seven-day requirement.
I am.
Number one, and number two, there's also some inherent authority of the court to control the order of how the court proceeds. Because this was filed on midnight, Saturday night, Sunday morning. It could have, under the theory, that theory, it could have been filed 1 second before the trial started.
I think that's correct, and I think that's the concern. I think that's why
Judge Moon... Why don't you go to the argument that you wanted to on the merits then?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I agree...
Pretty hard for you to say you were prejudiced when you won anyhow. I mean, the judge denied it.
I did. And one thing I will say, too, is even though we only had 15 seconds or whatever to formulate a response to the motion... and I did want to just, if I could just add to Judge Wilkinson, he did ask if there was cause or could you have a reason to consider a motion late? There is a safety valve in Rule 12 that allows for good cause shown late motions. So that's the other thing I just wanted to state about that particular rule. But it should be a default rule for the 7 days unless the court sets another scheduling order, which Judge Moon does not do. He does not have a motion schedule. So, within one of the things that I think the case law makes clear is that Mr. Heblich has stated, of course, that there wasn't a full hearing. There certainly wasn't an evidentiary hearing, pretrial hearing, before the trial. However, the case law shows that the court is allowed to rely on anything in the record. So anything that came out at trial is fair game to uphold the search as reasonable in this case.
We've had situations where there's been a pretrial hearing and then an additional evidence has come in at trial and the trial judge has referred to that additional evidence and amended the suppression opinion based on the trial.
And in fact, in this particular...
It's not uncommon.
It's not uncommon. And in
so
this
why don't
case,
you use the evidence then to make your argument?
Okay, Your Honor. Well, as this court knows, what was facing the officers at the time that they had a search warrant and they arrived at medical transport, first of all, their investigation had revealed that somebody, an employee, essentially, of medical transport...
Is it based on the search... Do you think the justification is based on the search warrant or exigent circumstances?
I think it's exigent circumstances. I also do think it inevitably would have been discovered because very shortly into the interview, the defendant confessed that the laptop had, that he had been downloading child pornography on that computer. So I think there's, if you look at the totality of the circumstances in this case, you can look at it as an exigent matter. The government has a substantial interest in making sure that child pornography is not...
Do you think the exigent circumstances are informed by the search warrant, although the search warrant and the probable cause in the search warrant doesn't, maybe doesn't completely justify the seizure, but do you think that a search warrant can inform, be part of the totality of circumstances that justify the view of seizure under exigent circumstances?
Absolutely. I think that's very important because obviously the law encourages law enforcement officers to use the process for a search warrant application.
It'd be silly to say that an exigent circumstance where there'd been no probable cause determination about at least the general subject matter was better than an exigent circumstance of search where a judicial officer had at least said generally something in that area is should be searched and seized, don't you think?
Yes. And in this case, and as the trial actually showed, Mr. Brown often had his computer at the facility. So if that day, fortuitously, the computer had been inside the facility, certainly the officers would have been able to seize that computer for further search. I think what's noteworthy in this case, too, is that the officers acted reasonably. I have not heard an alternative type of action that these officers could have taken that would have been
reasonable. And what were the exigent circumstances, in your opinion?
That there was a computer. They knew that a computer that was used either by Mr. Brown or Mr. Yarbrough should contain evidence of child pornography. They had basically probable cause at that point that someone was downloading child pornography at that facility, and it was a particular crew, Mr. Brown or Mr. Yarbrough. The officers originally thought it was Mr. Yarbrough for a variety of reasons, and that came out at trial as well. So they knew what confronted them at that time is they had a search warrant that was based on a historical investigation of downloading at the IP address, the Internet Protocol address that was associated.
So what was the agent circumstance to actually seize that computer, though?
Because they knew Mr. Brown was the only one that had the computer that day. Mr. Yarbrough did not. So it was reasonable for them to believe that this computer may have been the instrumentality of the crime. They knew that the search warrant...
But suppose they hadn't seized the computer. What do you think would have happened?
They would have interviewed him. He would have confessed. It was a consensual interview. He was told he was free to leave. During his testimony, he tried to suggest that he was somehow browbeaten into giving
a confession. Was there a danger to the images on the computer that was going to be destroyed as ever?
I don't know whether the ambulance was locked, but it was a computer that was left in a vehicle.
I'm astounded that you're having trouble answering these questions. I thought you were going to say the exigent circumstance is that if there's reason to believe it should be seized, that you have to worry about what would otherwise happen to a laptop computer.
Absolutely. I'm sorry.
Would be thrown away or the images would be deleted. Isn't that the exigent circumstance?
Absolutely, because if he was allowed to leave with that computer, that evidence would have gone away. So it was reasonable for the officers to seize it and then get a second warrant, which they got after their brief investigation, to search all the evidence that they had seized. I'm sorry if I had said this in our point.
Is there anything further, Ms.
Hill? They got a warrant to look at the end of the computer.
They got a warrant to further search the evidence that they had recovered. And Mr. Heblich's right. The warrants were not put into evidence. I offered them to the court.
What he says is true, then. This record is devoid of the warrants?
That's correct.
Or the affidavits for the warrants, both.
They were state warrants, so they were not in the underlying record, and no, they weren't.
But they're a matter of public record. Are they something we could take judicial notice of if we wanted to?
I think there were enough facts that were elicited. There's no contest of the facts. I think everything that
came up. First of all, that's not the question he asked you.
Surely not.
I'm sorry.
Answer his question. He asked you, I don't have to read, he asked you, could we take public notice of those search warrants? Yes or no would be the answer to that question. Are they on public record somewhere in some other cases?
You said they're in state court.
They should be in state court, yes.
And I talk about search warrants after, if we wanted to. But
I believe that's correct. Unless there are, yes, the court would have access to them. But I think there were enough facts also set forth both in the motion to suppress and during the course of the trial about the search warrants and about the actions of the law enforcement officers that justified what they did.
Did the court see the search warrant?
No, they weren't attached to the motion.
Why wouldn't you show that to the court? I'm asking.
I offered it to the court at the beginning of the hearing.
So you did show it to the court. I mean, you offered to show it to the court.
I offered to show it to the court.
And you did at the hearing that morning before the trial?
That's correct.
And he said, I've read the motion, and I'm satisfied to deny it.
Yes, he said
he did it on the basis of the motion, which says what Brown said. Are there any laptops in the ambulance? And Brown says yes, and they got it from him.
Right, and he found that there was no search.
The judge was satisfied that was enough.
That's correct. But he did hear the motion was repeated various times during the trial.
I understand.
And the evidence was objected to at the appropriate time when it was offered into evidence.
But if we just look at it at the time he ruled on it that morning, your position, I assume, the government's not saying he needed anything later, but there's anything needed later, that he was right in ruling that what the officers did on the events when they went out there to execute the search warrant and didn't find anything, but seized it from the fellow when he drove up in the ambulance, that the officer acted reasonably.
Yes, he found no search. And he did deny it even way further into the trial. He did deny it again by saying, I deny it both as being untimely and meritless. And he did use both of those terms, basically. I don't know if he said meritless,
right, but
he
you,
did
Ms.
find.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Haber.
On the issue of exigent circumstances, I think there is an important fact that is in the record that the court would consider. If the court's trying to, at this level, trying to review what happened in the district court and decide whether it can affirm based on the evidence in front of it. And that is that the evidence that the police used to get the search warrant to create probable cause was obtained on May the 5th. So that was when they did their surveillance, and that was when they determined that there was child pornography being downloaded to this particular IP address. And it's June 17th, it's 6 weeks later when they go.
So you say the evidence is all stale? You say the evidence is stale?
No, staleness wasn't, I think it's stale as to exigent circumstances. I don't think I'm not arguing that the warrant was invalid or that the information used in the warrant was invalid. That wasn't raised. But I think as to exigent circumstances, if you confront exigent circumstances and the best evidence that you have is 6 weeks old and you're acting on something that's occurring right in front of you, I don't believe that supports, as a matter of law, supports a finding of exigent circumstances. As I said, the police didn't know what was on that computer. The only thing they knew was that Brown had the computer and he didn't bring it inside to the office. He left it in the ambulance. So, I mean, I suppose the police could have gone to the employer and said, our warrant doesn't cover on its face.
You know what this all sounds like? This all sounds like very good arguments to be made to the district court if the motion is timely made. That's what that sounds like to me.
Well, that's the relief that we've asked for, is to remand the case.
No, you're missing the point. If it had been timely made, these are the exact kind of issues in the first instance that a district court looks at, hears argument on, and decides. In this case, the motion could have been made much earlier. I'm just kind of astounded, quite frankly. I guess it's because of electronic filing that you could even file something on a Saturday night. I would say that augurs against electronic filing because it disrupts the flow of the court. In my opinion, is that what it was? Did you walk down and drop it in the mailbox at the court on one day, or was it electronically filed? Do you know?
We have electronic filing.
Well, I was going to point out, that's one thing you have. Technology butts its head up against the court and the court activity, because nobody expects the court personnel or the judge to really get this at midnight on Saturday night or early Sunday morning.
Well,
but that all points out why, had it been timely made, then you could have had time to argue every bit of this to the district court. Every bit of the argument you're making, and anything more you could think of, which you could reasonably argue.
Well, I'm not arguing that it was convenient to the court, that it wasn't a burden to the court. I'm not arguing any of those things. But
Are you arguing that it was timely?
I'm arguing it was timely because it complies with the rule.
Well, I'm saying, but the point is, if you read those two rules together, maybe it wasn't timely. And if you read those two rules together to say it wasn't timely, this exactly points out why it would not be considered timely.
Well,
I understand you don't read the rules that way.
I don't. And it seems to me that the council's entitled to rely on the language of the rules.
You have to read the rules together. Number two, but isn't this...
Was he represented by the public defender at the time? I mean, you're the federal public defender.
Yes, sir.
Was he represented by the federal public defender's office?
No.
He had a court-appointed lawyer?
No, he retained counsel.
He had a retained lawyer?
That's right.
Okay.
Now, this is not relevant.
Yeah, I bet the public defender's office would not have done this.
No.
I mean, that's what I was
We originally were appointed.
I don't think that you fellas would do something like
that. We were originally appointed to represent Mr. Brown, and then after several weeks, he decided to retain counsel. So we weren't representing him.
My point is this. The kind of argument we're listening to this morning, the points being raised, isn't that typical of the type of suppression argument that it, in the first instance, is made to a district judge?
Well, of course it is, Your Honor, and I've done it in my sleep.
I'm sure you have.
And you would have done this
a month before trial, and you would have had a hearing, and you would have presented your evidence, and you'd probably submitted the judge briefs, and he had had a chance to study them and write an opinion. And none of that was available here.
That's right.
So what he came in with was a motion which he looked at and basically accepted as true and said it's not enough, lose. So we look at it. We have to take what the cards we're dealt, just like you do. I wonder why everything that the officers did wasn't perfectly reasonable. And it seems to me it jumps off the page that they were.
Is your timeliness argument just
my time, my own timeliness has just expired. Thank you.
Well, excuse me,
but his time has
expired. I just read your timeliness argument just seems not to go beyond the corners of Rule 12. And the difficulty, if you just read Rule 12 in isolation, sure, following must be raised before trial. But aren't you just ignoring the phrase that the Rule 47 applies to a pretrial motion, a motion to suppress clearly being a pretrial motion?
Well, but Rule 47 doesn't say that it applies to a suppression motion.
Rule 12 does.
Rule 12 does. And the committee note on Rule 47 said that it's a general, the seven-day rule is a general rule, and that it's superseded by the particular rules, including Rule 12. So what it says is the general rule, but then you have other... And the reason for that is that the suppression motion is one of those dispositive motions, and it has to be addressed before trial. Otherwise, if the court addresses it after the trial's commenced, it's a jeopardy, and then jeopardy is...
It says Rule 47 applies to a pretrial motion. It doesn't say some pretrial motions. It says to a pretrial motion, and then that a party must serve a written motion. Well, this was a written motion.
That's right.
It's called a motion to suppress. I just didn't see how you could get out of the fact that these Rule 47 and Rule 12 are interlocking.
Well, because then you go back to Rule 47, and Rule 47 says that it's superseded by Rule 12.
Well, It may be.
And Rule 12 doesn't have a...
Normally, when we have a cross-reference, which is what we have here, you have to look at both rules and not just one.
Nothing in Rule 12 says there's not a seven-day requirement.
No, but Rule 47 does.
I know it does.
Rule 47 says that Rule 12 does, it controls the time on this issue.
Excuse me? It doesn't say, Rule 12 does not say there's not a seven-day requirement. It doesn't say that.
It doesn't say there's any requirement.
No, but that's because, but Rule 47 does. Rule 47 doesn't say that Rule 12 completely writes out everything we say.
But the Rule 47... That's why you read
it. It doesn't say that. Rule 47 does not, the committee note actually, it doesn't say that if you use Rule 12, then none of the times in Rule 47, none of them applies. It doesn't say that.
It just says that the particular rules, and one of Rule 12 is one of the rules that's identified as a particular rule that supersedes Rule 47.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Everett.
Thank you, Judge.
We'll come down, greet counsel, and take a short recess.